like that because I thought that's how disgusting I was. That it should hurt. That I should be ashamed because I was his sickness and she was his medicine. He probably fucked her on a bed of flowers for all I know. Who the fuck knows anything? But I do know I ain't nobody's sickness. I've done that. I have to go, I say. I have practice. Well, go on and run, then. Go on and run, but me, I won't be nobody's sickness. I don't look at him as I walk down the steps to Florida Avenue, but I know he hasn't moved. I'm not doing anything wrong, Damien shouts at me. I'm not. So fuck you if you want to be this way. Just fuck you. His words chase me up 16th Street. I speed without care for the cameras or cops, weaving between the slow rollers and the trucks groaning out towards the beltway. I stop at church and park the car against the curb, leaving the blinkers on. We used to race up these steps as kids. Back then, they seemed so tall and so many, like they really could lead to heaven. Now they lead to a locked door that refuses to budge. I push and I pull, I kick, I curse, I say a prayer, but the doors don't move, even as I stare up at the sign that tells me all are welcome and plead silently to God for help. A police car pulls up behind my Volvo and an officer shouts from his open window, "Everything all right?" I turn around, but the glare from the sun prevents me from seeing any faces. "Yes, sir," I say. "Just dropping something off, but I can't get in." "Well, there's no standing here. You've got to move on," he says. I nod and walk down the steps. My mother is home, seated at the kitchen table when I get back. She is surprised to see me and quickly shuts her laptop as if she is doing something wrong. I know what she searches for, because it pops up in the browser on the desktop in her study, the only computer I'm allowed to use. How to talk to your gay son about sex is one. The others are about drug dosages, support bras, and Spanx. Everything no son wants to know anything about. But it's hard to keep secrets in this house. "Shouldn't you be in school?" she asks, as she smooths her hair back and pushes her glasses up her nose. She is 50, but has only started to gray at her temples. The wisps of silver make her look magical, like she combs tinsel into her hair. Her teenage patients say it makes her look like a pop star. "Track doesn't start until late, and most of my periods today are free," I say. She pushes back her chair as she stands and says, "Well, are you hungry?" My mother is not a small woman. She is taller than most other women, and the thin frame of her youth is thicker now. Not Oprah, but far from Iman, who she holds as an ideal for the physical form of a woman her age. When she begins to mother, she grows smaller and less intimidating. "How did I give birth to such giants?" my mother says as she passes me. She touches my cheek and then stops. She asks, "What's the problem?" "Nothing," I say. "Okay," she says as she moves to the fridge. "I can warm some spaghetti. You people always say you want to eat pasta before you run, isn't it?" I stand at the kitchen counter watching her fuss at items in the fridge and talk to something wedged in the very back. "I don't know who keeps putting this thing back here," she mutters. "It must be your father." She turns around with hands full of cucumbers and lettuce. "Can you make the salad?" she says. "Mommy, I'm not hungry," I say. She says, "Anyway, if you don't eat now, then we can eat it with dinner. Skin these." She hands me cucumbers. "And wash these," she says, launching a box of cherry tomatoes to the counter. I rummage around the drawer for a peeler. I can't find it, so I grab a knife. "You are going to hurt yourself with that," my mother says. "Mommy, I can use a knife." Just use the peeler, she says. It's in the drawer next to the measuring cups. I didn't see anything there, I say, and start on the cucumbers, cutting the tips so I can peel back the skin in thin strips. We have not worked together in the kitchen for a long time, ever since my father made it clear he didn't think boys should spend too much time learning how to bake. I feel her watching me, hovering, her eyes reaching like desperate hands to steady my motions and prevent an accidental slip of the blade's sharp edge. Sometimes I wonder who my mother might be if she weren't married to my father. Everyone around him seems that much less free-spirited, that much less open to possibility, so much more controlled. At her office, she is loud and filled with infectious laughter. Here, she is more quiet and deferential. I can cut a cucumber, I say more sharply than I intend. She winces and busies herself with searching for the vegetable peeler, if only to make a point. Utensils clatter as she sifts through metal and silverware in the drawers. Your father is always moving things around here, she says over the clink and clatter. That's because you just throw things in drawers, I say. But I know where I put them until you all decide to mess everything up. I say, I cook almost never, so it's not me. All I wanted was an empty house and a moment of quiet to process everything Damien has said. I thought I would be able to sit quietly at the kitchen table, or even on one of the metal chairs on the deck facing the trees separating our house from the neighbors'. Don't be rude, my mother says. I'm not being rude. And don't interrupt me, she says in her voice that stops even my father mid-sentence. She turns to face me with her arms crossed over her chest and her rear against the open drawer. The lights above shine on spoons, can openers, and stainless steel measuring cups that OJ and I bought her for her birthday some time ago, when we still had to ask my parents for money to buy them birthday gifts. I groan softly against my clenched teeth, but she hears me all the same. She says, Enough. Enough. Just enough. It's too much already. I've never, thank God, had a problem with any of my children. But now all of a sudden it's like you are three different people, and I don't ever know which one I'm going to get. It's exhausting, you hear me? You are exhausting me. Can we not just have some real, genuine peace in this house? Between you and your father, everyone here is always walking around like someone has died or someone is about to die. Or people are shouting or sulking or whatever it is you men do. You see my hair? You people are making me old. For once, can someone not fucking shout at me for something? I say. I can't wait until I'm out of this stupid fucking place and no one can yell at me. My mother's mouth falls open and her eyes lock onto my face. She has heard me swear before, on the phone, when joking with friends, but never have I said any such thing to either of my parents. Never. I have always assumed that such an event would result in my being beaten within an inch of my unborn grandchild's life, but she just stands there like a malfunctioning robot. Is anyone keeping you here? She says finally. If you are unhappy, please go. Go and find the place where you feel happy. I'm sorry, I say, but it's too late. I've fucked up. The less I've said, the better things have been. The less likely my father has seemed ready to pounce on me for the smallest mistake. If she tells him what has happened, this might be the end. I'm really sorry. My hands smell of cucumber as I wipe my nose. She tosses the vegetable peeler in her hand to the counter between us. Its protected blades glint in the sunlight streaming through the large bay windows. Do what you like, she says. Mommy, wait, please, I say. Get out of here. I don't want to talk to you, not like this in my house, my mother says. Her voice is flat and hard, her eyes fixed directly to mine. You should go and find whatever it is you want to find. Me, Seth, I'm tired. I'm going upstairs, she says. I listen to her reach the top stair, enter her bedroom, and shut the door. It's just me now. Chapter 9. For some of us, this is the end of a season, the culmination of 3 months' worth of gut-busting hard work, Coach Erickson says. It's hard to hear him over cheering from the bleachers as the track teams from rival high schools arrive and parents transform into fans and fanatics. The sun bears down on us. We sweat, but haven't even started our warm-up laps. For others, it's the end of the road, the last time you will ever run competitively. Whichever one it is, doesn't matter. Today, we're going to leave it all on the track, every last drop of sweat, every ounce of energy. We are going to leave it here, and we are going to take that title, Coach Erickson says. We all cheer, because this is what we are supposed to do. But I know that everyone is nervous. The relay teams have botched handoffs twice this season. One of our high jumpers sprained his ankle playing pickup soccer. He wears sunglasses and a baseball hat with his sweats. But he's a junior, so for him, there's always next year. I want to see personal bests, Coach Erickson says. And if you're not racing, you're warming up or cooling down. And if you're not doing either of those, then you're cheering your heart out for this team. All right, bring it in. Adam? Our hands stretch toward the center of a circle where Adam starts to hop from left foot to right foot while bobbing his head. We're on a new level, he shouts. We're on a new level, we shout back. We're on a new level. We're on a new level. He calls, and we respond with more and more energy until we are all bouncing and shouting, and the sweat starts to drip down our faces. We break into hoots and hollers, streaming towards the sun-baked orange track for our two-team warm-up laps. According to tradition, seniors link arms and lead these last laps at the championship meet. I join my classmates at the front. Adam says, "We're almost there, Harvard." And rubs my head. Let's do this. As we pass the packed bleachers where fathers have taken off suit jackets and rolled up their sleeves, and mothers fan themselves with their programs, I notice my parents standing together amidst a sea of white faces. My mother wears a pantsuit, which means she has come from the hospital, and my father wears dictator aviators while he holds his gray suit jacket folded over his arm. They wave when they see me, but my arms are locked between my teammates. I can only nod and smile. If my mother hasn't said anything to my father by now, she probably never will. But she still hasn't said much to me this past week either. When we finish stretching, I take a moment to myself underneath the large maple trees on the far side of the track. It's almost over. All of these people who have dominated my life ever since I became self-aware will soon fade away, and there will be new people and new structures. I haven't told Coach Erickson that I'm not going to run at Harvard. Not that I don't see the point, but I'm tired of running in circles while thinking that I'm making progress. And yet, it is progress. I can see the seconds and milliseconds shed from my time. I cross the finish line before everyone else, accept their smiles and high fives and fist bumps, and then line up to do it all again because that's what I'm supposed to do. I don't want that life. Damien said I don't have to have that life, but we haven't spoken since I left his apartment and I'm too afraid to call. We're still friends, right? Meredith says. She stands over me in her black warm-ups with purple and gold stripes at the sleeves. Her hair is pulled back into a ponytail. She has a cartilage piercing in her right ear. I think it's new. I thought you weren't talking to me anymore, I say. She wears racing flats instead of trainers, and she keeps bouncing to stay loose. I wasn't, but then Rowan asked me to prom. Oh, that's nice, I say. I told him I was going with you. Please save me from that hideous creature. Please. She sits down next to me, slips her arm through my arm, and rests her head on my shoulder. I mean, you can't already have a date or something, she says. I tried to talk to you, I say without looking at her. I sent you notes. I bought you candy. It was good, she says. And also, you can't draw for shit. I wasn't drawing for shit. I was drawing for you. Very funny, she says. So we're cool? Totally cool. You'll go with me? I don't say anything. Meredith stands up and dusts her hands off. I'm going to Barnard, by the way, she says. I look up. She smiles. Wait, seriously? Congrats. I start to get up, but she waves me down. You can celebrate with me tonight. River Run. I nod yes. Every senior goes to River Run and has gone for as long as track has existed. It's how we know the season is over. It involves alcohol and the Potomac River, and only seniors are allowed. The school hates it, but what can they do besides issue warnings to kids they can't really punish? I'll see you there, Meredith says, before she jogs off to join the girls stretching in a circle on the grass. I would much rather see Damien than go to River Run. I pull my phone from my bag and punch in his number. It rings, but he doesn't pick up. I hurl the phone against a tree trunk. It bounces off and lands at my feet, undented, unscratched. I am losing my pride, I tell myself. Nehru, get over here, Coach Erickson shouts at me from the infield. I change into my racing shoes. The moment before the gun goes off is always the most silent. Your world is quiet, but it is not calm. The runners around you bounce and flex and relax, flex and relax. They slap their faces for motivation. They look to the sky and mumble prayers to God. The coaches shout instructions, and the teammates cheer, as do the fans in the stands. But you cannot hear because you are somewhere else, somewhere deep inside, preparing your body to deal with the coming pain, the breath sucked from you, your limbs on fire and the voices that won't let you stop. They say, keep moving. It gets better. It will be better if you can only break through this pain. They say there's another life after this torture. A new level. Just keep breathing. Then the gunshot, and your body no longer belongs to you. Yes, you are there. You are present. But you are no longer in control. Whatever happens from this point happens, and all you can do, all you must do now is breathe. Keep breathing. Don't lose your nerve. Don't choke. No matter how much it hurts, don't stop breathing. Otherwise, it will all be over before it's time. They cheer for me. I can't breathe. Harvard isn't going to know what hit them, I hear. I can't breathe. We are the champions, I hear. We are the champions, they sing around me. I can't breathe. Your personal best by a long shot. That's Coach Erickson's voice. That's my boy. It's my father. It's like I'm dying, trying to hold on. My body says, oh no, and my knees buckle, but so many arms are around me, they hold me up. The voices, they say, breathe. Keep breathing. They bring me water. They bring me something sweet, and then they lay me down in the soft grass where I feel the blades against my tingling skin. The parents mill about the bleachers and track to congratulate and collect their various offspring when the meet is done. My father leans against the chain link fence separating the bleachers from the track, his shades over his eyes, sleeves rolled up. He smiles at me. A full-on, I see you smile that must have only ever occupied his face at the moment I was born. He waves at me as I sift through seniors and our supporters, speaking words of humble thanks and goodbyes. My medals hang around my neck. Our team trophy has passed from hand to hand as we take pictures so that later, when we have children, we can prove that we were once active and fit. My father doesn't have these pictures. He has the war, but he smiles all the same. He says congratulations and holds his hand out to shake mine. I accept, and his rough palms grip my hands tightly. Your mother had to go back to work, he says. She's proud of you. We're proud of you. I'm proud of you. My stomach flutters. My parents do not say things like, I'm proud of you, or I love you, often. My mother, more than my father, which is still almost never. They show their love by paying our tuitions, OJ says, and by putting food on the table. They show they are proud by demanding even more than you think you can do. OJ is coming for my graduation. His girlfriend, too. He says he is proud of me, but he doesn't know me. When we get to the car, my father hands me the key, still smiling. He says, you should drive. My father doesn't joke with his car, this Range Rover, a gift to himself, bought a year ago, the week after the board elevated him from COO to CEO. It is metallic midnight blue with deep brown leather seats and a grill curved upwards into a smug luxury car smile. OJ had managed to convince him to let him take the car on runs to the grocery store, but no farther. I have sat in the driver's seat and fiddled with the steering and controls when the car was in the driveway, but nothing more. You sure? I say. You know, I didn't learn to drive until I entered university, my father says. The license plate shines in the sunlight under a glimmering Range Rover logo. My father's car has no stickers or decals, unlike my mother's Mercedes with its Harvard sticker peeling from the bumper. I couldn't afford to. What money was there to buy a car? My father says, as he rests his hand on the side panel, then removes it immediately. The car is hot. I didn't know this, but I now file it with the long list of things he lacked growing up that he has given to us that we should be grateful for, like private school, piano lessons, and family vacations to Venice and Prague and Rio de Janeiro. OJ says our father lives somewhere between the self-satisfaction that his success has made us soft and disgust that we are unacquainted with the brutal intensity of a world that he has effectively tamed for us. Nguangwa, let's move, my father says. But as soon as we sit down, there are questions. Did you check that you are in park? But Daddy, you parked the car. I assumed you wouldn't never assume. Emergency brake, he asks. I push the button and feel a satisfying click. Do you know what all these lights mean? He asks. My father takes his Mont Blanc pen from his pocket and reaches across the center console to point at the dashboard. Okay, tell me. Tell you what? I say, now regretting not riding back on the bus.
You need to know these things. You don't want to be one of those people who just drives. That's what women do. A man should know what he's getting into. You should know what you are getting into, my father says.
He's the kind of person who reads manuals for everything. Order and instruction. Rules for this, laws for that. How-to diagrams and flowcharts to show a clear path towards a clear goal. Maybe you should just drive, I say. My father says nothing for a moment before he shakes his head like he's shaking away a fog.
No, he says. Let's get going.
My phone buzzes in the center console between us. It's Damien.
Nguan,
my father says.
You can't be looking at your phone and driving.
I pick up the phone and quickly slip it between my thighs. Then I pull out of the lot. I learned how to drive with my mother because my father couldn't sit still. From the first movement forward, my father's involuntary motions started. He chewed his lips while curling and uncurling his fingers on the armrest as the car gradually picked up speed. He tapped his feet and craned his neck to search for traffic and threats that I couldn't see. Manage the car, manage the road, manage my father. It was altogether too much work. Things have not changed. My phone buzzes again, and I look down.
You have to watch the road,
my father shouts. I can't, I say. I can't watch the road when I'm too busy watching you.
Well, don't watch me then. Focus on where you are going.
I can't not watch you. My phone buzzes again.
Who is calling you like this?
My father asks.
Here, give it to me, he says. If you can't focus, then give me your phone.
He reaches for my legs. The car swerves as I push his hand away. He braces with one hand against the dash and the other wrapped tighter around his armrest. I slam the brakes. We screech to a stop, and the cars behind us on the GW Parkway begin a symphony of angry horns. Someone passing in the next lane shouts, "The fuck is your problem?" through his closed window.
You've got to pull to the other side of the road. We can't stay here,
my father says. He presses on the hazard lights.
I think you should drive, I say. Don't be ridiculous. Let's get moving. We are causing a scene.
No, I think you should drive, I say. I can't drive with you in the car. It makes me too nervous.
Well, you'd better learn, 'cause you can't drive without me in this car. Now let's move.
I say no. I'm not driving. You should drive. That's what you want.
I wanted to do something nice for my son,
he mutters.
I can't believe this. Why are you so fine? Come down from there.
I put the car in park and engage the emergency brake. When the doors open, the honking reaches its full intensity. The car horns harmonize and clash in an improvised, syncopated rhythm.
You guys okay?
A youngish, red-haired soccer mom asks as she rolls by in her red Chevy Tahoe. Her sunglasses sit on her forehead. She has crow's feet and freckles near her eyes.
Just a little car trouble. Think it will be okay. Thanks for asking,
my father says in his clipped tone reserved for white people. I pick up my phone and step out of the Rover. A long line of cars stretches behind us down the GW Parkway. The Potomac River uncurls and expands, even as it wraps around the city, and the cathedral glowers down on us. Somewhere in this mass of hatchbacks and SUVs, some mom is worried about being late again to get to her kid's Little League game. And some dad is worried about being late again to pick up the kids for their weekend with him under these new and still strange custody arrangements. Some Salvadorian with no papers but lots of drywall in the bed of his pickup is worried because each minute in traffic is a minute more of possible exposure to law enforcement. And who needs that? They are all now taking their anger out on me. My father brushes by me and sits down in the driver's seat. Then I hear the hood pop, and he walks to the front of the car, muttering,
I can't believe this.
I put my hands to my forehead and whisper the same thing. I want to shout, there is nothing wrong with the car, and then add a, you fucking idiot, for good measure. But I stand silently between the car and the sloping, grass-filled median, holding my breath.
Will you get in the car, please?
My father asks. I walk around the back and smile at the older white man tapping his fingers against the steering wheel of a late-model Cadillac. I open the passenger door, but I don't get in. I shut the door and then close my eyes. A moment later, I feel the hood slam shut. My father theatrically dusts his hands. The back of his shirt is soaked through with sweat.
You all right over there, sir?
Asks another driver, a young white guy with shaggy hair and sunglasses.
I think so,
my father booms back, and then dismisses the guy with a head nod and casual wave.
Niru, will you get in the car, please?
He says as he climbs into the driver's seat. He doesn't look at me as he turns his attention to adjusting the rearview mirror. I clutch the door handle and bounce on my toes. My calves burn.
Get in the car now, he shouts.
I can feel his anger vibrate against the closed window.
What's wrong with you?
Our eyes lock through the glass. He checks the rearview mirror again. It will never stop, I say. Carpe diem, I say. My phone buzzes.
Niru, just get in. Get in and let's talk about this.
He reaches across the seats to try and push the door open from the inside, but I press my body forward against it. I listen to the hot metal of the engine click as the car idles. I smell the exhaust from cars creeping slowly by. Their horns have not stopped. Their horns will never stop. My phone buzzes. Then I turn and run through the cars to the shoulder lane. My legs are so tired. My chest burns, but I don't stop. Just keep breathing, I tell myself. It gets better.
Niru,
my father shouts.
Please come back. Talk to me.
But there is nothing left to say.
Part 2. Meredith. Chapter 1. The day I return, a homeless man comes up to me as I stand looking up at the gilded ceilings and shield-bearing Valkyries in the main hall of Union Station. He smells of urine and drink. His white beard has red streaks from malnutrition. "You look lost," he says. "Are you lost?" I tell him I'm fine and rummage through my backpack for the first note I can fish out from the miscellany I dumped inside before I left New York. It's a crumpled and worn 5 that I hold out at arm's length with my fingertips. He only has a few teeth that wiggle when he smiles. His eyes water. "God bless you, you have a good heart," he says, before he wanders away across the patterned floor towards another traveler. "Are you lost if you know where you are going, just not how to get there?" There is still no metro rail service to Georgetown, and taking a bus, taxi, or Uber during rush hour means conjuring a level of patience with this city that I have never possessed. I stand in place, weighing options, while the transit goddesses stare down their unwelcoming disapproval. But it's early summer, and the sun still shines in the evening, so I decide to walk the 3 miles across town through a place I no longer consider home. The Capitol building squats atop its hill, and the Washington Monument remains singular and unmoved, enjoying its prominence only because of arcane regulations that have stunted the growth of surrounding buildings. I had a high school teacher who used to tell us that the game is rigged with winners and losers decided long before the players have any choices to make. Ms. McConnell lives in Los Angeles now and writes for television. I wonder if she's happier there, or just less oppressed. I have never really liked this city. It was forced on me against my will by ambitious parents in search of greater opportunities and better lives. That's why everyone comes here, to this seductive monument to self-advancement, or at the very least, self-preservation. It's a city that doesn't take risks. Men wear boxy suit jackets over golf shirts tucked into khakis. Women wear sensible skirts, pantsuits, and pumps. They all pull roller backpacks behind them because of subway ads enumerating the signs and evils of scoliosis as they walk to big box buildings made of similarly colored sandstone. You can't get lost here because there's nothing to lose yourself in. These avenues, at least downtown, are not built for wanderers, and these monuments are constructed to inspire awe, not contemplation. But things have changed, if only to protect the desire to remain the same. The streets have more barricades because the streets have more impromptu protesters, a dismal lot with their poster board signs and hoarse-voiced chants against the monster in power and his minions. There are more armored vehicles now, and more police officers in tactical gear and body armor wielding large black guns. It's a brave new world wrapped around the old one to make it great again. I think about my boyfriend in New York and how he wraps his arms around me when I have my nightmares. They're less frequent now, but no less intense. Or in the mornings when we are both naked and vulnerable, and that vulnerability arouses him. Sometimes it arouses me too, but sometimes it is easier not to resist. He wanted to come with me because he wants to know where I'm from. I'm here now with you, I told him. But he says, with me it's a case of the more you see, the less you know. He wants to meet my parents, to see the house I grew up in, to smell the bedsheets of my youth. He's a poet trapped in a banker's body. He reads T.S. Eliot on the subway and slips index cards with lines from the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock into my pockets before he goes to work. My parents are moving, I told him. There is only so much change they can handle. They are not home when I arrive. Mom has left a short note on the front door written in barely legible cursive that she insists makes sense. Dad and I waited as long as we could, but we had to go to a dinner. I made some boxes for you and put them in your bedroom. Leftover salmon in the fridge. Love, Mom. She could text, but she doesn't text when she wants to make a point. Inside, there are boxes everywhere, in the living room and dining room, all open, some empty, some half full. I drop my backpack on a couch and weave my way through the chaos to the kitchen, where the counters are covered in dishware sets that I never knew we had. A broom and mop lean against the refrigerator door. I try to hold both of them in place as I pull it open, but they slip from my grasp and fall to the floor with a clatter. The fridge is empty, except for a box which contains the salmon. There is also some milk and a Brita of water. This must be heaven for Mom. She hates to cook. I warm the brown paper box in the microwave, fill a blue-tinted glass tumbler on the counter full of water, and stand with my back against the fridge, feeling it vibrate and hum while I pick at the salmon with my fingers. The flesh is tough and rubbery. It needs salt, but Mom has already packed the condiments. Leaving must be difficult for them, for Mom especially. She is the one with extensive social ties, the friends she plays tennis with, the boards she sits on, the professional women's groups she has started and grown. I wonder if my absence has anything to do with their willingness to move. Whenever we talk, Dad says, "This house is too large for two people, and since you never come home, what's the point of keeping it?" They will move to an apartment in Cambridge, Massachusetts, courtesy of Dad's new job, a professorship and head of institute. Mom says she has always wanted to live in a place overlooking the river, even if that river is frozen half the year. She wanted me to come back earlier. It takes longer than you think to pack up a life, she scolded on the phone. But that depends on how expansive the life. Ever since I left Washington, I have tried to contain my world in the smallest space possible. Don't keep anything that can't be packed into two suitcases. Don't attach yourself too strongly to people or places. My boyfriend says I have commitment issues. When we argue, I tell him attachment and commitment are two very different things. Dogs are attached. Humans are committed, I say. He wants to get a dog, but I'm not ready for that. Maybe that will change after they move, and I'm really homeless. Mom has left packing tape on a stand outside my bedroom. There is also a box marked Donate in the hallway. She has never been subtle in her suggestions. It's not how she was raised, she reminds us. Her family is large and argumentative. They show and tell. Sometimes it drives Dad crazy. Otherwise, my room remains untouched. The same framed posters, because Mom would only tolerate them if they were framed, the same creaky black office chair and a white desk with red drawers. Dad and I painted it when he still had time, and I still had patience. It's the kind of thing a person keeps, if a person keeps things. Mom said, "You'll regret it," when I told her she should sell it on Craigslist or eBay. "Maybe we'll put it in storage," she said. "My grandchildren will thank me." "If you have them," I mumbled, which she chose to ignore. Mom has opened my closet and placed a wardrobe box in front of years of clothes hanging undisturbed. They smell vaguely of cedar. I have no need for more clothes in New York, so I pull what's in front of me from the bar without ceremony and prepare for the cathartic dump into the donate box. Then I see it, hidden in the back of the closet where it could almost remain unnoticed, a blue and white windbreaker jacket with a little bit of shimmer. My breath stops as my stomach clenches, and I am reminded in full force why I don't come home. Nehru wore that jacket on the last day I saw him. The last time he came over to my house. Chapter 2. I am 18, and I sit on my front steps with my legs pressed together at the knees against the urge to use the bathroom. It's silly to wait for him out here, bouncing puppy-like with anticipation for someone I have not really spoken to over the last 2 months, but the idea of waiting fascinates me. These moments stacked upon moments to be traded for an experience that may never live up to the anticipation. I should go inside and relieve myself, shower and wash away the dried sweat and grime from today's track meet, but I don't. Nehru appears suddenly at the intersection with its slowly moving traffic, walking with the slight limp of a man who has just run for his life. He wears his blue and white warm-ups, and as he approaches, I run through all the possible ways to stage a greeting. We aren't who we used to be. I can't touch him the way I used to touch him. My hands can't linger on his back. My head can't rest on his shoulder. When he reaches me, he rasps a breathless hello. His face is still fresh, but his movements are deliberate and old. I slide sideways towards the bed of ivy with leaves that cradle last night's stormwater and pat the warm bluestone beside me. I reach out, pull him down by his hands, and throw my arm over his shoulder. This seems acceptable. He doesn't tense or withdraw. We sit quietly and watch the sunlight slide across the houses towards the Georgetown University clock tower. It catches on the silver and chrome handles of cars parked against the curb. After a long while, Nehru says, "I want to disappear. I want to disappear completely. Gone. Nothing. No trace. Forever." "Stop," I say, and place my free hand over his mouth. His lips are sticky, but I don't pull back. "They'll sweep the streets tomorrow," I say. I feel his shoulders relax, and my fingers grow warm as he lets out a long breath. "They'll sweep the streets, and everybody will park on the opposite side, no questions asked." "What does that have to do with anything?" he says. "Nothing," I say, "except that it helped you forget, for a second." "I can't help you disappear," I whisper into his ear, "but I can help you forget." I say, "I will help you," and press my lips to the short, prickly hairs of his recently shaved temple before I take his hand and lead him up the steps to my front door. The house is empty, so it's just us. My parents trust me enough to leave for a weekend in New York. Work, Dad said, and opera, Mom said. The track team wanted me to host something, but I've never liked the idea of many other people in my space, on top of the things I know, touching them with their grubby fingers, leaving unfamiliar smudges and scents. Sometimes it is better to go to the world than to bring the world to you. We order a pizza and lie across the couches in the upstairs den as we wait for it to arrive. I make frustrated attempts to turn the thick pages of a coffee table book about Greece with my toes, while Nehru stares at the ceiling and pops his lips. He says nothing as his fingertips hang just above the fraying border of a faded blue Persian rug. The curtains glow with the sun, and the room smells of the flowering trees outside. Dad's roll-top desk refuses to close over unruly document stacks, magazines, and business cards. "It's the only corner of this house where I feel like I'm allowed to be myself," he says sometimes. But mostly he ignores it, and this room is totally mine. "River Run," I say. "That will be fun. It's finally the end. Finally." Nehru isn't interested in that line of conversation, though he seems not altogether unmoved by the suggestion. His head rolls towards me. He puckers his lips and blows a sarcastic kiss before he turns away. He mumbles, "All of those people, the same old people, the same old shenanigans, the same old jokes." "But for the last time," I say. "Then never again, if you don't want." "Or what do you want?" I ask. "Something different," he says. "Something more real, or maybe I just want to disappear." "What gives?" I say, rising to my feet too fast so the world swoons. I fall back to the couch, overcome by a very real fatigue and dehydration from the meat. I search for my Nalgene bottle on the floor near my feet. Niru's popping stops. He swings his feet around too quickly and unsettles Mom's carefully arranged coffee table books. He doesn't look at me. His eyes come to rest on the scaled replica of John Trumbull's Declaration of Independence that I hate, that Mom hates, that Dad considers part of his freedom corner. He is patriotic, but not sentimental, so Mom and I think the placement is ironic, but it stays because Dad sometimes feels like a minority in his own home. Niru grinds his teeth, places both hands on his knees, and sits up perfectly straight, and lets out a wordless scream. Tears drip slowly from his eyes. I move toward him, drop to my knees, and plant myself in front of him. The full blast of his breath hits my face, and he refuses to look at me, even when I place my palms on his cheeks and then over his mouth. "You're scaring me," I say. "Niru, I'm here with you," I shout, and I shout everything I have heard said by people to people with too much pain. "It will be okay. You'll get through this. This too shall pass." The last phrase being something a mom likes to mutter. "The neighbors," I plead. His eyes say, "Fuck your neighbors," but then they say something much more terrifying. They say nothing at all. "Can you see me? You need to stop, Niru, please stop," I say from between his knees. "Please stop, you have to stop." I dig my nails into his forearms and thump a knee against the rug. "Help me. Tell me what to do. Tell me how to make it stop," I say. This could just be one of his practical jokes, like that time he pretended to seize in front of me and gargled Sprite to make his mouth foam. I dialed 9 and then 1 with sweaty fingers while I rubbed his chest and said, "Stay with me," before his arm flailed in just the right motion to knock my phone from my hand, before he laughed loud enough to fill the kitchen. I poured ice water on him for revenge, but his startled yelp couldn't match my cold, trembling fear that made it almost impossible to hit the right numbers to save his life. The doorbell rings. I say, "I think the pizza's here. Are you going to be okay if I go down to get it?" He replaces a lock of my hair that has slipped from my ponytail back behind my ear. I dash downstairs to the door and impatiently thrust a tip in the delivery man's hand. I snatch the box from him. "It's okay, Meredith," Niru says when I get back. "Everything will be okay. I just need to be strong. You just need to be strong." We sit at the kitchen counter with the box of Papa John's before us. I am still dumbfounded by his performance upstairs. I ask, "Are you okay?" But of course, he responds in a silly imitation of a French accent. "Mais oui, certainement." I don't press, but he can see that I'm unsettled. I want to hug him, to hold him, but I also want to slap him until he can see that, objectively, his life is almost perfect. The world loves him. It takes him seriously. Harvard takes him seriously. I drag a pizza slice from the box to a plate and hand it to him. "I was just letting off some steam," he says. "Sometimes there's just too much pressure." "Well, you're acting really weird," I say. "Dude, you've got to relax. The school year is over. All we have to do is literally stay alive long enough to graduate, and then we get to go to college, where life will be totally different. It's not that far away." "Not for you," he says. "You never have any real pressure." "Hey," I say, but I don't say any more than that. I have always felt like he dismisses my problems, because in his mind, white people don't have real problems, just issues. He picks a sausage from his pizza slice and places it on his tongue. "The boy I was seeing doesn't want to see me anymore, and I just ran away from home," he says. "Wait, what?" I say. "Slow down. There's a boy? What boy?" He wants to smile the bashful smile of a person who likes someone, but his eyes are sad. "You didn't tell me about a boy." "You didn't speak to me for a long time," he says. "Things change, but it doesn't matter. I have nothing now." Aren't we being a little dramatic? I left my dad on the GW Parkway, ran away from him, from all that. I can't take it anymore. It's crushing me. It's too confusing for me to live all these lives when I only want one. I don't know what to say, so I ask him if he wants water. I want to see him. Who, Damien? The guy? He nods. Tell him to come to River Run, I say, but Niru raises his eyebrow, and I suddenly feel stupid. Join that fuckery? With Adam and your lover boy Rowan? No, thank you. He's in college. Ooh, sophisticated, I say, with much more bite than I think I mean, because something pinches inside my heart. I say, I can't believe you have a boyfriend. He is quiet. Niru wants to go to a club or bar on 14th Street because it's close to where Damien lives. I can call him and maybe he'll come, he says. I want to tell him he's dreaming, but I don't because he's hurting, and I want to be a good friend. You have a fake ID, he says, and I have my brother's license, which you've never used, I say. He gives me the side eye. He says, just help me with this, with eyes full of please and thank you all mixed together. But what about River Run? We'll go after, he says, and I'll buy you a drink if you come with me, something better than the cheap beer they'll have by the river, he says. You'll have to buy me more than one. 14th Street is alive with bodies by the time we get there. The weather is nice, so people linger on the streets. There are women in short sequined or pastel shorts and tight short skirts, revealing tops and made-up faces. There are surrounding men who all look the same, awkward, with shirts tucked into jeans or khakis that fall over boxy black or brown shoes. Their pale skin turns orange in the streetlight. If this is real life, I want very little of it, but Niru wants it all. He charges ahead towards the bouncers at the busiest place on the street, where the chatter from multiple meaningless conversations competes with top 40 pop that beats against the windows and spills into the street. My hand shakes when I produce a license that I got because everyone else was getting one. It says I'm from Maryland, that my name is Amy, and that I am 23 years old. I don't look like I'm 23 yet, because I don't wear my clothes and makeup with the same confidence as the women around me. My jeans are the wrong choice in this heat, and I am unsteady in my heels, but my tank top is loose, and I like the latticed straps that show my back. Guys do too. I feel their fingertips in the space between my shoulder blades every time I wear it to a party. They touch me now when they say hello. They offer to buy me drinks. At first I say no, because Niru stands next to me, and even if he has his own agenda, part of me feels like it wouldn't look right. He shouts in my ear that his calls to Damien won't go through, and he holds his old Nokia phone in a tense hand with flexed muscles that stretch the arms of the too small golf shirt I produced for him from my father's closet. The bouncer didn't pay attention to his warm-up pants and sneakers. The track coaches are stylish enough to know that functionality doesn't always trump form. You go and find reception, I tell him. I'm a big girl. I'll be fine. I should be fine, because this will soon be my life in New York. Clubs with men my age and much older, all circulating in search of something that I supposedly have to give, that I'm still supposed to guard furiously, that I tried to give to the boy who has just left me at the bar alone so he can give it to someone else I have never seen. And I am here to help him. It hurts, even if nature always wins in the end. It hurts because loving someone is very often against your will at first, and there is no amount of will that can change the situation before me. I have tried. But I can also forget. Yes, I will take your drink, I say to the man with an ambitious smile. He asks my name with his beer breath and beautiful face and his dark frat boy hair. His hands touch the skin on my back, and I look around the room for Niru. Yes, I will take your drink, because I am a senior, even if you can't tell, and it's a Friday, and why not live a little in this strange space of irresponsibility before we become real humans? He says things about things that don't register. My friend is somewhere here, I say. He's coming back, I think, I say, listening to myself struggle with simple words and phrases. But he keeps on talking, and Niru hasn't come back yet, and I can feel my heart. I am always someone's accessory, someone's afterthought, the supporting actress in another person's drama, and that thought fills me with fire. My parents leave me alone for the weekends because they have each other. My friends want to use me for my house. Rowan wants me because he thinks I'm less noticeable and therefore easier to fuck on prom night. And this bro with his wavy hair and his pale outstretched hand and his fingers that creep up my back, he wants me, and that scares me, but I smile. "It's so loud. Maybe we can talk somewhere more quiet," he says as he pulls closer and his hands move lower. I can feel the part of him that wants more of me than I'm prepared to offer, but I wobble as I try to step away because I don't often wear heels. There are other bodies in the flashing lights and loud noise that bump against mine and his, pressing us together. Then, there is Niru's hand on my shoulder, and his body behind mine, and his tearful eyes, and that phone which he holds, still quivering. The frat boy notes the separation with a frown. Niru says, "He's not coming, we should go, like, now." "But I'm not ready to go," I say, because now it feels good to know that I can make someone forget their manners. Niru grabs my wrist. I try to wave his arm away because I'm tired, and with alcohol I feel better standing in place. Backlit and surrounded by the pulse and chatter, he seems taller than his full 6'2". He holds me tightly. "Can we go?" he says, with eyes that say please and thank you. "I'm not going anywhere," I say.
"Dude, she said leave her alone," someone says.
"Come on, let's go. Remember River Run," he says to me, softer now, in my ear, ignoring the bristling bro behind me.
"She said to leave her alone."
"Please don't touch me," Niru says to this boy whose name I can't remember, or maybe he never told me. "Or what?" the frat boy says, and I can't believe this is happening. "Niru, you're hurting me."
"Meredith, we need to go."
There is a half moon of bystanders around us now, waiting for something to happen so they can tell each other, "Remember that time when he was like 6'4"? Dude, he looked like he just got out of prison. Total thug, complete felon. Yeah. There are no bouncers, but there should be bouncers for moments like this. Or maybe I should just go with him, with his hard eyes and now terrible face, his clenched fists and set jaw that the room treats with extreme wariness. I watch him play through events, the push and then punch that will surely follow, the scuffle and then the bouncers and police that will surely come. Am I worth it? To him, I'm not worth it. So he stands down and says, "Fine, Meredith, have fun," before he turns and walks away. I should let him go and let this strange night be the end of a long and strange year that we will talk about when we are older, at reunions, when our lives are far enough apart that we can only share memories. But I can't. It would be easier if he hated me, because at least then he would have to acknowledge me the way he acknowledges Rowan. He always seems indifferent to me. He is unaffected by my naked body, unmoved by my years of silent longing, so unconcerned with my well-being that he would leave me here with these wolf packs of young men. I try, but I can't let go of the fact that he left for Nigeria and when he came back began to phase me out of his life. I pull away from the frat boy who clutches at me and asks if I'm okay. I start after my so-called friend, through doors onto a street filled with people and the smell of street food, pizza, alcohol, bodies. I see car lights, street lamps, and changing street lights, and it makes me dizzy. I hear too much happiness and laughter buzzing in the air around me, and it makes me sick. Niru isn't far ahead now, just a few paces with his steps still smug, even after that momentary humiliation. I feel so unsteady that I think I'll fall. I shout his name as he turns the corner into an alleyway, and then I surge the way I do in a race or on runs when the competitive jerk in him picks up the pace and I don't want to feel inadequate. When I catch him midway down the alley, I push him from behind with a force that carries us forward to the ground. He is on his feet in an instant. I feel the full strength of his hold as he lifts me up and pushes me against a wall just beside a dumpster. The smell makes me nauseous, but the pulse and throb of the music blasting from inside feels soothing. It's so loud, I can't hear myself screaming, but I know I'm screaming. I try to scratch at him. I try to slap him. I try to knee him in the groin, but he puts his full weight into holding me still. His body presses against mine as he mouths, "Calm down. Meredith, calm the fuck down." He bleeds from his face, from the pavement burn.